Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair and Panoply. I'm Katie Rich, the deputy editor of VanityFair.com, and I'm here in person with Vanity Fair's digital director, Mike Hogan.
Hi, Katie.
And on the line is Vanity Fair's senior writer, Joanna Robinson.
Hi, Katie.
We've lost Richard this morning, but for a really good reason. He is with the New York Film Critics Circle, who are voting on their awards literally as we speak. They're tweeting them out on a Twitter feed. As you listen to this, this will all be old news that you'll have known for a while. But so far, Richard has helped Mahershala Ali get a Best Supporting Actor award. Casey Affleck got Best Actor, Zootopia Animated Film, and O.J. Made in America got Best Documentary. So the latest news from Richard's very nice critics group, and we're really excited he's a member. So
cool.
We can't begrudge him too much. He did offer to duck in the bathroom and call us and give us live updates. We'll just have to wait for all the good gossip. But it's kind of fitting that he's with the New York Film Critics Circle right now, because this is a really big week for Critics Awards and also the Gotham Awards and also whatever the National Board of Review is. You know, as soon as December starts, really, all of a sudden you get a flood of not just things that are contending to try to win an award, but actual awards being handed out. And it's kind of an open question how much any of this means. There is pretty much no overlap between critics groups, the National Board of Review, the Gotham Awards, and actual Academy voters. And that doesn't even get into the Golden Globe nominations, which come out in about a week and a half, and will be a whole nother wrinkle in this. But we've gotten some sense of at least what people are talking about, and a lot of movies that are going to be able to put award winner on their screeners or DVDs or whatever else. Let's talk about it, Mike. I mean, there's so many things to sort through. You know, Moonlight won a bunch of Gotham Awards. Then you have the National Board of Review, which said that Manchester by the Sea was the best film. The Critics' Choice Awards nominations just came out, and Hacksaw Ridge really made a big stand. I don't know. What are you taking away from this big mess of titles?
I'm taking away that Mahershala Ali is going to win the Oscar for Moonlight.
Yep, that really
seems to be a consistent thing.
He did not get it from National Board of Review. They went from Jeff Bridges in Hell or High Water. But
I mean,
National Board of Review, they have been known to go their own way. Yeah.
I don't know. I think Moonlight and Manchester by the Sea are clearly popping up again and again and again. Mm-hmm. Hacksaw Ridge, where a lot of us are kind of asking ourselves, do we need to take Hacksaw Ridge more seriously than we thought we needed to take it? Maybe not. But I think you can't really, count out Mel Gibson, a comeback story or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, he got the Best Director nomination from the Critics' Choice Awards, which really surprised me.
Yeah.
Because I think people had talked about the movie maybe and Andrew Garfield, but I don't think Mel Gibson Best Director was something anyone was really ready for.
Yeah, so I don't ever think you can count out Mel Gibson. You can never count out a giant movie star in a non-movie star category.
Yeah.
That's kind of a rule.
And a comeback story, right?
And a comeback story. And there's some revenge thing going on this year.
Well, isn't the whole idea of Hacksaw Ridge that it's, a World War II story? It's straight up morality, where he is an American hero. He is rescuing America. It's, it's kind of like La La Land, in that it's about things that are good and are bad, and doesn't have the thorny ethical issues that we are so faced with in real life.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the only problem, we don't have to get into
all
that.
He's killing Nazis.
The problem with movies like this and Allied right now is you're like, who am I rooting for in this situation now? But anyway, I'm really happy to see Casey Affleck winning for Manchester by the Sea at the Film Critics Circle. I'm really happy to see Manchester and Moonlight floating up near the top, along with La La Land, which has been getting lots and lots of, it feels like a three-way race a little bit
Manchester,
right now,
La
potentially.
La Land and
Moonlight. And I know we're going to come back to Best Picture, but those feel like the movies that have the most traction of all
that
so
are showing
far.
Up kind of across the board.
Yeah.
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 Joanna, what are you noticing?
Yeah, I agree with Mike completely. This is like the whole J.K. Simmons narrative or the Patricia Arquette narrative with Mahershala Ali. It just feels right and consistent. We were already feeling like Viola Davis was, you know, in a good place for supporting actress. Casey Affleck, I would love to see him win that Best Actor Oscar. So all these wins make me happy to know that Manchester is not too dark for people to vote for.
Well, not too dark for critics who can, you know, sometimes be more able to handle things than Academy voters.
Definitely, definitely. You know, so it feels like the acting categories are firming up, except for that elusive Best Actress category that we've been talking about. And then it feels like, you know, OJ Made in America is a lock for Best Documentary after what we've seen from these critics.
Yeah, nobody seems worried about the fact that it's 8 hours long or whatever.
I think the fact that it's 8 hours long helps it. Maybe it's like, it's so massive, you have to honor it. Like Wiener, which is also great, is like a brisk 90 minutes. And, you know, maybe it like feels like less important somehow, even though it shouldn't.
I'm interested about, in terms of animated, you know, to see Kubo win Best Animated from National Board of Review is really interesting to me. I know that NBR does not have a good track record in predicting things, but the animated category is one I'm really interested in watching.
You know, the thing that the NBR can do, even if they're not predicting things, that Kubo can now say, hey, the NBR won it, and someone might be convinced to put the Kubo screener in their DVD at some point down the road. You know, it all kind of helps this elusive idea of buzz, even if individually it doesn't necessarily mean anything.
Right.
Well, how about Amy Adams winning the National Board of Review Best Actress?
Yeah, I was just gonna
I like seeing that.
As Joanna mentioned, like Best Actress we think is going to shape up, but then Amy Adams wins for Arrival at National Board of Review. Isabelle Huppert really surprised people by winning for Elle at the Gotham.
I could see both of them getting nominated.
Yeah. And yeah. I mean, in Arrival, like I was going to talk about this for Best Picture as well. Arrival is a box office hit and pretty much nothing else in the running is. I mean, many of these movies haven't opened yet, so it's not really a fair comparison. But I think when you've got Arrival as a movie, a lot of people have seen that people like Amy Adams is obviously someone people like. Like there's a lot of strength in that. And I think we were talking just a few weeks ago about how it's like a good performance, but understated and like it might not be here, but that really seems to be changing now.
Well, should we talk about Jackie then? Because we have to talk about it at some point.
Well, yeah. So I finally saw Jackie, and I think you guys talked about this, you know, while I was still gone and maybe litigated it then, but I loved it, and Mike has been watching me with a raised eyebrow ever since I said that.
Interesting.
It actually opens tomorrow. This is more topical than I thought. It's finally opening in limited release tomorrow.
See it. It's worth seeing. My biggest concern that I have, or thing that drove me crazy, is that Natalie is doing like a very extreme Jackie Kennedy accent, and then Peter Sarsgaard is playing RFK with her in many scenes, one-on-one scenes, and doing no accent.
Like, and I just slight accent, I think maybe.
Maybe
I'm no Boston accent expert.
Yeah, where's Richard when we need him?
You could call that a small thing, but to me, it's a microcosm of a movie that doesn't know what it is, because that's a film-wide decision. I'm sorry, you can't have one actor
one
be like, let's do like a perfect accent that is an impression of Jackie Kennedy, which I think is really quite challenging. Let's just put it that way, to pull
she
off
had a
effectively.
Weird accent. She did not talk like anyone did before or since.
Yeah. And I think it's so challenging that I might have suggested just, I don't know what I would have done. But it's weird that one of them did it and the other didn't do it. And to me, that's kind of symbolic of a film that just does not really hold together.
This reminds me of my reaction to the Silence trailer, which I felt, you know, I haven't seen the film yet. I know several people have, but
Richard has seen it, but so he's off voting on it right now.
Right. But like, you know, it's a Scorsese film. It looks amazing. This is a huge, long passion project of his. And then Andrew Garfield and Adam Driver open their mouths. And I'm like, what are these Portuguese accents that you're doing? And why didn't Scorsese just say, let's not do accents? Like, you don't have to do the accent. If you're not nailing the accent, don't do the accent.
But you got to pick one for a film, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Well, now, look, it's not a bad movie. It's an interesting movie worth watching. Everyone should definitely check it out. It'll play into the season. But to me, it didn't really work. And again, like, I don't have a whole lot of critiques for it other than this specific one. It's, I don't know. It just felt.
It's definitely going for something. It's the kind of thing where you have to really buy into it. It's very interior. It's really focused on her. There's maybe one scene without Natalie Portman on screen. And you have to accept the score that's kind of weird. And you have to accept the cinematography and like focusing on seemingly minor moments in her life. You know, there's this tracking shot on her listening to a musician play a concert in the East Room of the White House. And I thought that stuff was totally captivating, but it's a choice. And it's definitely something that can just as easily alienate people.
It felt camp to me. It devolved into camp. By the time she's tearing up the East Wing listening to opera and chain smoking or whatever it was. I was like, this. I mean, maybe it's just my straight guy glasses were getting foggy.
That didn't feel camp to me. It didn't feel, I mean, it doesn't feel like totally realistic.
It felt like John Waters to me.
Joanna, you've seen Jackie?
No, I have not yet. I'm excited, though.
What I really loved was just seeing this movie that's about a woman who's suddenly in power but not in power, and she's in the White House but she's not in the White House, and everyone wants to defer to her but everyone wants to steamroll her, and she's got this strength that she has to kind of choose when to show. There's a great scene where she tells off Jack Valenti, who went on to become the president of the EPAA. I totally forgot that he was Lyndon Johnson's assistant or, you know, some kind of role in the White House. And I just thought he analyzed that really interesting way. And I tweeted this that after the election, I was kind of really looking for movies about women in the world. And I saw Jackie, 20th Century Women, and Arrival all really close together. Yeah. And I thought all of them really accomplished that in really different ways.
Yeah.
I thought the way Jackie was made in this like really specific focused way on her and her feelings or lack thereof, or kind of, you know, going back and forth between her trying to have this strong public face for the nation and then kind of tearing apart Billy Crudup in these interview scenes, which I thought were really fun. It just kind of... Well, then Billy Crudup also shows up in 20th Century Women with Jackie co-star Greta Gerwig.
He's great in 20th Century Women.
He's great in 20th Century Women.
Give me 12 of him in 20th Century Women.
Yeah, I mean, all of these films are going to be part of the general Best Picture conversation.
Well, it's an interesting point you make because I saw it before the Trump victory. Mm-hmm. And Rebecca Keegan wrote a good piece for us, you know, talking to a few different filmmakers, including Jeff Nichols, who did Loving. Mm-hmm. She talked to Ben Affleck, too, about how the meaning of a film changes after an event like this. I mean, everything sort of changes. And, and Loving is a film that I don't know how I would have reacted to it before, but after I found it incredibly moving and frankly disturbing, because the whole point of the action in Loving is to try to get this case out of the kind of redneck racist assholes who were in charge in Virginia and to the Supreme Court, where they would actually see that it's not okay to punish people and torment them because they are in love and they happen to be of different races.
Yeah.
And what really worried me watching it, just not to, again, get political, is like, we're headed in the opposite direction in this country. You're going to go the other direction, if anything, now.
I mean, I think, you know, they probably made Loving in an atmosphere. It was not that long after the Supreme Court case that legalized gay marriage. Like, it felt like it had this resonance. It's like, oh, you know, this is a previous victory. Now we have these other victories. And you watch it now. I mean, there's only 8 people on the Supreme Court. Like, it's in such a state of disarray that you kind of feels like this harkening back to an era that we might be moving away from, which makes it, I think, more important to watch.
No, it really feels like a pendulum that was at the opposite end, you know?
Yeah.
And so I would actually be interested in seeing Jackie again. It's totally an interesting film.
Yeah.
I didn't think it was 100% successful, but I would be interested to see it in light of this. And I also appreciate what you're saying about a woman in power, but not in power.
Yeah.
The Crown also has been a great thing to watch for that reason, not to keep bringing up The Crown.
Well, too bad we can't nominate Crown for it. If OJ Made America can win an Oscar, why not the Crown?
The Crown could just be Best Picture. Why not?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, we wanted to talk about Best Picture in general because, you know, these Critics Awards do interesting things for Casey Affleck and Mahershala Ali. But I think when you start thinking about a Best Picture lineup of between 5 and 10 movies, it's starting to become clear which, you know, maybe 12 titles might fill in that space.
Yeah.
So I put together a working list of what I thought would probably be in there that I can just rattle off. And you guys can tell me if I'm crazy. I mean, I think there's 4 that we can all agree will almost certainly be on there, which La La Land, Manchester by the Sea, Arrival, and Moonlight. Does that seem fair?
Yeah.
Yes.
I do think so.
So from there, then you get into Fences, Jackie, Lion, which I finally saw, and I feel like we can talk about this. I feel like people are sleeping on that movie. It's kind of the Weinstein's big hope for the season, and it's really powerful.
Well, when I did my Gold Derby picks and was looking at what everybody had, I realized I need to see it. I'm going to see it this week.
Yeah.
It's on a lot of people's lists.
Yeah. And then so you get into Hell or High Water, which again, like, showed up in a big way on the Critics' Choice Awards, Hacksaw Ridge as well.
I do not think Hell or High Water will be a Best Picture nominee.
I have a really hard time.
I'm going to come right down and say it. It's not good enough.
But that might be a Trump voter movie.
I don't want to keep, but
my dad is a Trump voter, will not stop talking about how much he loved Hell or High Water.
Really?
The people who loved Hell or High Water, like, loved it.
Because Jeff Bridges is, like, making fun of his Native American partner? Or what's the appeal?
The corruption of the banks and how it's keeping down the middle class American, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, to Hell or High Water's credit, it's a kind of a modern day Western, but it has a lot on its mind in terms of, like, modern financial insecurity, which, you know, a lot of people will argue is what the election was about. So, no, Joanna, you have a point.
I didn't like it, but, you know, I have to respect how often it keeps coming up with other people that I talk to, who don't have my interests, who don't like the gay black movie Moonlight that I loved, you know?
Well, you know what? That's a valid point. Let's try to stay out of the bubble.
Yeah.
You know, it did not serve as well predicting, I know, but it's a different kind of a bubble.
Yeah, Academy voters are in their own bubble, which is slightly
and not many of them are working class.
The Academy voter bubble is more like our bubble than the West Texas bubble.
Well, Jeff Wells has hell or high water at number five.
Well,
and
then
he's the only probable Trump voter I can think of in this whole world. So he there you go.
Okay, so beyond that, this kind of in the list on maybe more on the fringes, Silence, which has screened, the reviews are not yet, but it sounds more like an art experiment than, you know, maybe like The Revenant, something that would pop up and take over the Oscar race. Yeah. 20th Century Women, which we
I do think
about.
With Silence, you just get this kind of like, it's Marty. It's Marty's movie.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you got
and
to, right?
It almost like just gets in. Although you could have said that about Warren Beatty. I mean, it depends. If it doesn't have a big box office thing, but people kind of respect it, then I think it's got a relatively easy path.
It's just, you know, it's a long movie about monks in Japan and people keep thinking it's boring.
But it's the kind of film that you don't see and you just put on a list to seem smart and because it's Marty. Sorry, but that's how I do believe this happens. Let's face it.
Although I wonder if like Moonlight is the movie or Manchester even. You know, that's the movie that like, you know, people like and you want to put on there.
Yeah.
I'm trying to see the last Marty movie that didn't get nominated for a Best Picture.
Ooh, I would like to know that.
Shutter Island, right? Like,
yeah, is that the last one? But Shutter Island was a huge hit. He kind of did the other side of things.
Yeah, that's interesting. But like even before Shutter Island, The Departed, The Aviator, Gangs of New York, it feels like, you know, if it's Marty, you have to do it.
When he's in classy mode, I mean, Shutter Island is more like pulp mode for him.
Right.
When he's in classy mode, it's hard to deny the Scorsese.
No, he's been on a real
And he went and met with the Pope and, all, you know, he's just like pulling all the Weinstein
Meeting
tricks.
With the Pope is my favorite Oscar campaign.
Yeah. You got to meet with the Pope at least once.
They
if
treat
you want
the Pope like
nomination.
He's an Academy voter. And I guess it works because people keep doing it. Although
if you could snot cry with the Pope, you would win.
Angelina did it with Unbroken and that didn't go anywhere. So it's not a guarantee. I can't remember if I mentioned Fences earlier. I don't think that's necessarily a sure bet, but it's really close to it, I think.
Yeah. And we were gushing about it, Richard and I, gushing pretty hard last week. Other people are now seeing it in feeling a little less special to be there because they're not the first or second round. And
because they didn't see it with Denzel in the room.
Right. And they're saying, you know, wait a minute, this is a play. I saw Guy Lodge gave it a B- and said something like the camera does not have the intensity of the actors.
Yeah, that sounds pretty fair.
So I think we'll see how Fences kind of takes. I thought it was incredibly moving and relevant in light of all the crazy things happening in our world, but it is very theatrical versus filmic. So we'll see how that works.
My sense is that, I mean, obviously we're talking about Best Picture right now, but my sense is that nobody is ramming down praise of performances.
No.
Like the Viola Davis narrative isn't changing. The Best Picture narrative might be. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Agreed.
I was just going to sit here and say that Doubt, which is the other play on screen that I could think of, made it into the last group of five Best Picture nominees, but it didn't. All the actors were nominated, but Doubt was not. So there might be precedent. I think Viola Davis and Denzel Washington are easily, you know, Viola Davis we all think is going to win. But
yeah,
I think the movie might have more of a challenge than I figured. Okay, so just run down the rest of the list. 20th Century Women, Sully, definitely still in there. Hidden Figures.
My dad loves Sully. I can tell you that.
My dad is, I have a Sully hat on my desk that my dad is very excited to get. He's going to get for Christmas. Hidden Figures, which I think we talked about briefly last week. Loving, which Critics' Choice included in the Best Picture lineup, I was glad to see, although it still feels like a real underdog. And then Patriots Day, which premiered at the AFI Fest in LA and is keeping a pretty quiet profile, but you know, that American sniper, patriotic kind of action-y movie, it's got Mark Wahlberg in it. I don't know. It doesn't seem like something we can count out either.
Yeah.
Yeah. The only thing I would add to your amazing list is like, I was looking at it and then I was looking at sort of the top box office earners of the year. Cause I, you know, last year, Mad Max snuck in. I feel like they sometimes try to put in a movie that was actually also really popular.
The Martian too.
Like Sully is the closest, but still pretty low. So I was wondering if Zootopia might not even get in there.
Ooh.
It's obviously going to be an animated, but like, That is just like sort of universally beloved and made so much money. I don't know. That's my wild card that I'm going to throw on the deck.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because when they first expanded the Best Picture lineup, it seemed like it was basically to include Pixar movies. They always had a slot in there. And it's been since Toy Story 3, I think, that an animated movie has made it into Best Picture. I guess Life of Pi, if you really want to count that, but I wouldn't do that. So the idea that you can get an animated film into Best Picture, it really flourished for a while there, and it has gone away. So I'd be really interested to see if they could make a case for Zootopia. I mean, I agree. That's an incredibly well-reviewed movie that actually made money, which they are really lacking in this year's race.
They really are. When you look at the top box office, it's just like staggering.
Yeah. Well, and that's
Batman v Superman, I do think could get in there.
Yeah, I think, yeah. Well, especially with
Steve Mnuchin
going to the White House. I think that's the argument for Arrival as well, which is at $64 million and counting. You know, it's made more than Ice Age Collision Course. It's what qualifies as a hit in this year's crop.
But it's still like 42. You know, Sully Elise is 19 on the top list. But when you look at like the top 10, it's like The Secret Life of Pets. I don't know, man. Deadpool? How about an Oscar nomination for Deadpool?
What about Fantastic Beasts? Is there any chance of that?
I just feel
not
like
not enough millennials.
I think for like visual effects, but not in Best Picture. Yeah.
I mean, do we think there's a chance that like La La Land becomes the, you know, Christmas season movie that everyone goes to see? It seems like every year there's something that emerges very late in the year that suddenly becomes a big hit and part of the conversation. You know, I think Star Wars came very close to a Best Picture nomination last year. La La Land isn't going to make that kind of money, obviously, but I don't see why La La Land couldn't be bigger than Arrival or Sully.
Yeah, it could zoom up the charts to like number 18. Beat out The Legend of Tarzan for the number 18 slot.
I mean,
slot,
guys,
maybe.
The Revenant made $183 million domestic.
Like, oh my God.
What weird things happen because you stop paying attention at the end of the year and then these Oscar movies make a lot of money in January and February and all of a sudden you've got American Sniper as the biggest movie of 2013.
I think La La Land, I think it's possible.
Yeah.
I mean, it could also make nothing.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
But I think it's possible. If it catches on, people like Ryan Gosling, I think people like Emma Stone, and there's a reason to go see it. I mean, The Revenant is that kind of like, you got to see it. It's this crazy experience.
Yeah.
You know, watch that bear fight. This one is the other sort of side of the spectrum, but, you know, there's like a, you got to see this, I don't know, song and dance numbers. It would be surprising, but wonderful.
Yeah. So last year we had, you know, The Big Short, Mad Max, The Martian, The Revenant, all like pretty solid box office hits. Then the year before that, it was really just American Sniper and then a bunch of movies that people saw, but like were not gigantic.
Is
hits.
There any time left for a Big Short complete come out of nowhere film that takes us all surprise?
I guess it's Patriots Day.
Patriots Day. What about Ben Affleck's movie?
Yeah, Live by Night. It's Screen. That's where Rebecca Keegan got that quote from Ben Affleck for the piece that she wrote. I guess I feel like if either of those were really going to take everyone by surprise, we'd be hearing more about them by now.
Yeah.
You're right, Katie, that Arrival is the closest that we get because out of these Critics' Choice Awards, the narrative is about La La Land, which nobody has seen yet, right? Moonlight and Manchester by the Sea. Moonlight and Manchester by the Sea are like 123 and like 189 in the box. Like, very few people have seen those two movies. Hopefully with the awards buzz, more people will see them. They're fabulous movies. But, you know, the Oscars doesn't want the reputation for being like so niche and elite that nobody wants to watch it because they haven't seen the movies that they're talking
about. Well, and at the end of the day, it's a trade organization whose goal is to like have a healthy box office. They do want to magnify movies that make money, not just have it be turned into art. Like there's plenty of critic groups that can do the art.
Yeah. Even if you get Best Picture nominations for things like Moonlight, if nobody watches the Oscars, does that then hurt the prospect of movies like that to get nominated next time? You know, looking at last year, like Room, I think, was kind of the underdog in last year's Best Picture lineup. It made $14 million, which is really good for a tiny little movie release. But for something that's going to be standing there shoulder to shoulder with Mad Max is, you know, maybe people want to move away from that. It's hard to know.
In spite of all that, for my first round of picks on Gold Derby, because I still haven't seen some things and there's some movies that I know are going to probably get nominated, but I don't like them. I was left with a few extra spots and I threw L, Captain Fantastic and The Lobster on there just to try and just remind people that those movies came out this year.
Yeah.
I love your love for Captain Fantastic. It makes me really happy every time.
I like it.
I've been stumping hard for a bigger splash and I really feel like Ralph Fiennes' Oscar campaign should be happening. It isn't for some reason. I don't even think they sent out screeners of it, but that's my oddball choice that I want to fight for.
I mean, now's the time.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
before we get into actually predicting the Best Picture winner, which we were going to do to wrap things up, I wanted to give room for, you know, stumping for whatever we've seen that we want to everyone to talk more about. Mike, do you feel like yours is Captain Fantastic?
Yeah, I think that is mine. That and The Lobster and Elle. You know, I've already talked a lot about Captain Fantastic, so we don't have to go into it. And Lobster. Elle, I do think Isabelle Huppert is likely to get nominated for it. That is a dark, freaky movie.
Yeah.
But it's really very, very good, I think, and just fascinating and disturbing. So that I like films like that.
Joanna, what do you want people to pay attention to or stump for?
This isn't in for the Best Picture category, but you sent this prompt out and I was thinking about it. And I'm going to go with The Edge of 17, which I think should get a screenplay nomination, because if Juno can win an Oscar for screenplay, this is a teen movie that really, really captures the way that kids actually talk, which Juno did not, obviously. And I think it's a really underrated, fantastic film. You know, Richard gave it a glowing, smashing review on Vanity Fair, but I think more people should be talking about it. It's a really lovely film. Not a Best Picture nominee, but certainly screenplay, I would say.
Yeah, I think that's a great space for this. I was going to talk about Loving, which we got into a little bit earlier, and I agree with basically everything Mike said. But I also think that Joel Edgerton is really great in it.
He is.
And Ruth Negga is the one that everyone's talking about, I think, because she's like an exciting ingenue. She's breaking out. She was on Preacher earlier this year. She's obviously got a big career ahead of her. And Joel Edgerton's been around for a while. And he's doing kind of the taciturn man performance thing. But he's just got this great, you know, his face just does a lot of work of this guy who doesn't want to talk a lot. You know, this couple made history at the Supreme Court, but they didn't go to watch the case be argued in the Supreme Court. They just wanted to stay home on their farmhouse. And I think Joel Edgerton captures so much of that while making him a real human.
Yeah.
Not just like a stereotype of like a rural white guy who just wants to be left alone, but he captures so much real feeling in this guy who doesn't actually say much. I was really impressed.
Well, and I tell you, the more you know about Joel Edgerton, the more impressive this performance is.
What's your Joel Edgerton story? It sounds like you...
first of all, having seen him in a bunch of stuff, but second of all, having met him a few times, because he always comes through the portrait studios that we do at the film festivals, and he came to our Cannes party last year. Joel Edgerton's a ton of fun. Mm-hmm. He is like a big...
It's like a body Australian, right?
Personality. And for him to play this incredibly clenched, convincing, you know, rural guy who's caught in this very complicated situation and is just trying to protect his family. By the way, I mean, that's another thing that's resonant in this time period, I think, sadly, is the idea of trying to protect your family from a hostile government. Yeah. I mean, you know, this stuff is real.
Yeah.
And he plays it so well, but it's so different from who he is. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a really good performance. And the teeth, holy smokes.
Yeah. He was also great in Midnight Special, the other movie that Jeff Nichols directed this year.
Yeah, I think Michael Shannon are both involved.
Michael Shannon is, I think, wonderful in that he was on my Critics' Choice ballot for Best Actor. They both were. But yeah, they all had quite a year together.
You want to talk about accent work, Mike? Joel Edgerton and Ruth Negga both don't take a step wrong, I think, in Loving. So
yeah.
I don't know why that matters to me. It just does, because it doesn't, like, it takes you out of the performance if, like, these vowels are falling flat and you're just like, yeah. But Ruth Negga, who's British, and Joel Edgerton, who's Australian, are deeply convincing here. So
while we're talking about accents, and this is a little bit of a digression, but is Forest Whitaker doing an accent in Arrival, or...
Yes.
I think he is. What
I
is
think
he,
so.
Where is he?
I think he was doing like Baltimore, I want to say, something like that.
I felt like it kind of came in and out, and it doesn't, I really liked Arrival, doesn't really take away from it for me, but it was a mystery that I was trying to solve.
You're right. There is a weird sort of subtle accent going on with Forest Whitaker.
Okay, so let's wrap up our Best Picture conversation by going big before we go home and just predicting what's going to win Best Picture, which in the first week of December, you're usually wrong. So it's still a fun and games with no pressure. Joanna, why don't you go first?
Okay, so my pick is informed by what we've seen, this narrative out of the early critics awards. And it's that I think Mahershala Ali is going to win, you know, an acting award for Moonlight, and Casey Affleck's going to win an acting award for Manchester by the Sea. I'm not sure about the other one, so I would say I think La La Land will win Best Picture. That's what I think.
But you're not sure if Emma Stone will win along with it? Is that the...
Like I said, I still don't know about that category, but I feel like they're going to give Manchester and Moonlight a nod via acting and then give the real big push to La La Land.
Can I just co-sign on what Joanna said? I feel like she's got it exactly right.
I think
right.
We all agree.
Maybe we know more than we think. I think, Mike, you tweeted someone did a thread of the New York Times writing about the Oscar race in the first week of December for the last 5 years. It was like, unlike most years, a frontrunner has not emerged. And for the last 5 years, they said the exact same thing. And we have all done this. This is not just the New York Times, but
I mean, I think the only giant variable with this is if the movie flops, it will that will cut into, like, Moonlight actually has done well right in its per theater averages, but nobody expects Moonlight to be a big hit.
Yeah.
I think La La Land, part of what's built into the idea of it being Best Picture is that it will be a crowd pleaser.
A big old crowd pleaser.
So if people kind of, if somehow people were to go and just be like, meh, I don't like this, you know, then I don't think it would win. But if it connects with an audience, it doesn't have to become number 18 on the box office list for the year.
Yeah.
But if it connects with an audience and becomes a thing that people are excited about, I think it will win because it's delightful and it's inventive and it's a nice escape from a weird year, and I think it'll win.
I just looked up The Artist. It made $44 million domestic. That seems like...
The Artist.
Yeah, which won Best Picture, and you know, it's a musical, kind of.
Yeah, that you kind of had to see. I mean, this one, The Cell is a little bit less obvious. The Artist was like, it's a silent movie. This one is a little bit more complicated to explain, but not really. It's a musical.
It's a musical, yeah, with cute actors who you like.
Yeah, in the real LA. That's what I think is so cool about it. If you've been to like the real LA and you know people are struggling actors or whatever, like this is what it looks like.
Yeah, it's not like strip malls and there's one very memorable traffic jam, but it's a very cute traffic jam. Like it's not overly cute. It's not quite 500 Days of Summer where it's so picturesque, but it's authentic while also looking a little bit nicer than like your crappy condo.
Yeah, yeah.
My favorite part for real LA is when Emma Stone is walking and stumbles upon the jazz club, but she's like walking through a street where there's just like random cars. You know, it's not fairy tale. This is a girl in her heels who has to get home and it's impossible. So from my bubble, which we talked about getting out of our bubbles, but from my bubble, La La Land is the number one most anticipated movie of December for people I know who haven't had advanced screenings are most excited about La La Land.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Just a side note, over Thanksgiving, I happened to watch Funny Face with Audrey Hepburn, just was on TV.
Yeah.
And they did this same thing in Paris. They have all these song and dance numbers that were very clearly shot in real Paris.
Yeah.
Fred Astaire and Audrey Hepburn running around doing these kind of goofy numbers. And then, of course, they create like a totally weird fake bohemian bar that's probably similar to the one in La La Land.
But, the jazz club.
Yeah. But it's funny. There is a certain kind of parallel between the two films. I think La La Land's a little better at the end of the day.
Well, that's because Emma Stone can sing and Audrey Hepburn, bless her, cannot. So,
but when she's dubbed, Audrey Hepburn sounded fantastic.
Fred Astaire can dance a little better than Ryan Gosling. I will throw that.
I think
out.
Ryan, just a smidge.
Oh, just throw out one crazy La La Land theory because I think I agree with all of this. So Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling were together in Crazy Stupid Love, which I think is where everyone started being like, put them in a movie together, and that movie's on cable all the time.
Ah,
and I think in terms of making something a hit, you know, Crazy Stupid Love was a decent sized hit, but it is on television constantly. And I think there is a fan base for the two of them that could drive this movie in terms of box office. That might or might not work.
I love
Academy voters, but the cable movie.
I know people who watch just the 20 minutes of that film that is the Ryan Gosling, Emma Stone.
Absolutely.
But that being said, what was it? Gangster Squad?
Yes.
Wasn't that the one that they were in together right after? Was just miserably flopped. So,
but like this was, but
maybe
you know,
not
it's
enough
like,
time.
Do you like that scene where they're in his house and they do the dirty dancing lift? Okay, here's a whole movie of them dancing together. It's like so
very
playing
true.
Right into that. So
all right, watch out, Jungle Book.
Yeah, Rogue One is going to have a hard time fending off La La Land at the box office. Okay, I think that does it for this week's Little Gold Men. Thank you so much for listening, and please rate and review us on iTunes if you can. It's a great time to get new listeners. We have so many awards to go through. We can help you sort through all of it. You can find us all at vanityfair.com, and on Twitter, we're all at Little Gold Men, and I'm at Katie Rich. Joanna?
Joe wrote this.
And Mike?
Mike_Hogan.
This episode was edited and produced by Alana Milner, and thanks to Laura Mayer and Andy Bowers at Panoply. And this week's award for the best description of 2016 thus far goes to Mike Hogan.
It devolved into camp.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me and maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.